The week is very quickly coming to a close here. I hope everybody's enjoyed themselves. Too much, yeah. I noticed the staff and some of the faculty were enjoying themselves a little too much as well. Seems like nobody's here this morning. Must have been a good concert last night. I couldn't make it myself. Well, we're here this hour to talk about the economics of the drug war. What we're not going to be talking about is the libertarian case against the war on drugs or drug prohibition. The libertarian case is that, you know, we should have the rights to do with our body whatever we want, to consume whatever we want. And the idea that the government could tell me I couldn't have a glass of wine or smoke some marijuana is the first step down the road to the government telling us what we can and cannot read, who we can and cannot associate with. And so the libertarian case is a matter of rights. It's a matter of morality and justice that we should be able to do with our bodies, basically with whatever we choose to do, as long as we don't hurt other people in the process. And it's actually that morality issue that gets the whole prohibitionist movement started. What we're actually going to be talking about here is the economics of the drug war and prohibition in general. And basically what I'm going to lay out here today, the reason we have this lecture is not just because people are interested in drugs and the war on drugs, but because it provides one of the best cases of showing you the differences between the Austrian view of the economy and the mainstream economic view of the economy. And in this case, the mainstream of economics is roughly correlated with the prohibitionist view of things like alcohol prohibition of the 1920s and the war on drugs. Okay, so the mainstream economic view of prohibition, the war on drugs, there we go. Is basically your standard basic intro economic view of a marketplace such as cocaine or marijuana or heroin or alcohol. It almost doesn't matter what the product is here. It's got a demand and there's a supply. And the mainstream economic view is, well, if we impose some kind of penalty, if we impose some kind of cost on this market, it's going to shift the supply curve to the left. So prohibition is going to take us from the market supply to this new supply. And so you've got the original quantity and the quantity supplied under prohibition. You've got the market price and you've got the prohibitionist price. And, one of the leading authorities from the mainstream of economics is Gary Becker, Professor Gary Becker from the University of Chicago. And this is essentially what he's suggesting is, instead of prohibition, you know, a lot of economists are actually against prohibition and they'd like to see the laws liberalized, but they still want to have the effect of prohibition. So Gary Becker's reform suggestion is that eliminate law enforcement from this and just impose a heavy excise tax on this product in order to drive the price up. So as you can see, the mainstream view is a price theory view. And of course, Austrians are big on prices. We're big on the price system and the market process. But that's not all we're big on. Is there any questions about that? Okay. Normally, yes, sir. Yes. Yes. The question is, you know, if you impose a heavy tax, won't you get people trying to run around the tax? And you, that would be one of the problems, is you'd have, like in today's market in alcohol, it's very common, particularly in southern states and up the Appalachian Mountains areas, for people to produce illegal moonshine whiskey and sell it without the tax. Yes, sir. Yeah, I'll be dealing with that. The question is, do you actually get a decrease in the quantity with prohibition? And I'll deal with that question as the lecture evolves. So basically, if you look at basic price theory, whether you impose it with a prohibition to decrease supply, or whether you simply add a heavy excise tax, on the idea is, you raise the price, ultimately, in the marketplace. You reduce the quantity. And so you generate social benefits. Okay? You may not get everyone. Now, there's some hard-headed prohibitionists in this country and around the world that think, well, what we should really be doing is driving quantity back to zero. You know, let's just execute people for smoking pot. And if that doesn't work, then torture them. Torture them in public for long periods of time and then kill them. And other countries actually do that kind of thing. You know, they may start cutting off your hands and, you know, beating you senseless. And for a second offense, they'll just kill you. They'll hang you in the public square. And it still doesn't work. But for Austrians, the price and the quantity are almost irrelevant in this scenario. Like I said, normally we have a big importance for price and quantity and market equilibrium and harmony between the production and the consumption of goods. We don't want government interfering with the price system. So we're typically very big on the price system. But with respect to prohibition, it almost doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because prohibition changes everything about the marketplace. It replaces the free market entirely. It displaces everybody who's producing, everybody who's distributing, everybody who's retailing. It displaces some of the consumers. It brings new consumers into the marketplace. So with respect to prohibition, this market is gone. And it's replaced by something entirely different. When we look at the quality of goods produced in a black market or in the underground economy, what we find is that the quality of those products is driven down. Okay, they're not produced in the same commercial way that products were produced previously. So the moonshine that's produced, actually I've tried it sometime, and sometimes it's really pretty good, but generally speaking, or maybe it may be just the fact that I'm not paying taxes to the government that makes it taste so much sweeter. But a lot of the times, it's really kind of rough, let's say. So quality is something that typically decreases in black markets. And the types of quality differences, you know, it's not just a matter of taste. It may be a matter of economic harm. Okay, so a prescription drug like Lipitor, which is supposed to reduce your cholesterol, supposedly. You know, if it's made by Pfizer or whatever, then the quality is really good. And if it's made by a generic company, well, it may be the same. It may not be quite the same. Generic drugs are thought to sometimes disperse through your body much quicker or slower than the original brand version of those drugs. So the quality may be diminished a little bit as it goes to a generic pharmaceutical company. But if I had this guy making up my Lipitor, that I would be very suspect about what exactly he, you know, I'd be like looking at the pill. And, but if you could sell Lipitor pills for like $50 a piece, you might consider actually going into the business. Set up a little lab, get the precursor chemicals, and go to town with it. But quality would be suspect. Now, the potency is one of the biggest issues that I've raised with respect to prohibition. And going back just briefly to quality, in some cases, the quality in a black market actually increases. So, for example, during alcohol prohibition, most of the alcohol that was consumed was of much poor quality. But some of the stuff that was bootlegged into the United States from abroad where it could be made commercially, you know, if you were importing single malt scotches and bootlegging them into the United States, you typically go with a very expensive brand that you would bootleg into the United States. So if you're overseas and you have the right to bring two bottles of spirits or whiskey into the country without paying taxes, typically people will bring in the most expensive bottles that they can get their hands on. So I went to Brazil a couple years ago for a conference down there at the Mises Institute of Brazil. I was able to bring two bottles back, and I brought back two bottles of Johnny Walker Blue, which is like $300 a bottle here in the United States. Down there, it's $150. And at the time, you couldn't even buy it in Auburn. It was illegal. You'd have to go all the way to Georgia to get it. So quality can go up in certain instances, but generally speaking, the quality goes down. Potency. Just like if you're importing something into the country, you would typically try to get a higher priced scotch to import legally into the country. When it comes to potency, producers try to bring in the most potent product available. So with cocaine and heroin, when it's imported into the United States initially, it comes in as nearly 100% pure cocaine and heroin. It's only when it gets into the United States that the potency is cut down to 30 or 40% or 20%. That's one of the things about illegal drugs is you never know exactly sure how potent that product is, which contributes a lot to the number of overdose deaths associated with that. Okay, so if you're running a boatload or an airplane load of marijuana into the country from South America, typically speaking, you're going to go after the most potent marijuana to get into the United States. You're going to try to get the most bang for your buck. Okay, so if you're looking at high potency pot, and low potency pot in Colombia, South America. Let's say the high potency pot is $20 a pound, and the low potency pot is $10 a pound. Do I get some price quotations out here? What was that? I'm just making these numbers up. I've never been officially to Colombia, South America. That's what you're looking at on the streets of Colombia, South America. But to get it into the United States, there's a lot of risk involved in importing it into the United States. You've got the Coast Guard patrolling the coasts of the United States. You've got the Customs Service and the TSA inspecting bags that come in on planes. You've got the U.S. military who is using satellites, planes, boats, ships, to try to keep tabs on anything leaving South America for the United States that isn't on schedule, isn't on its schedule. So there's a lot of risks. If you're caught, of course, with large amounts of this stuff, you're basically going to go to prison for the rest of your life. So the risk on a per pound basis is substantial. In Colombia, South America, the price is therefore 2 to 1. So it's twice as expensive. If we look at the risk of crossing this border from Colombia, South America to the U.S., it's going to be roughly, just throw out a figure, of $1,000 a pound. Now, you're going to be able to recoup that if you're successful in actually selling that in the distribution chain. But if we look at the total cost, of buying that pot and the risk associated with transporting it into the United States, adding that $1,000 risk fee, then the total cost afterwards, the difference is negligible. Okay, so it's basically the price is roughly 1 to 1. So for drug dealers and drug importers, smugglers, whatever you want to call them, I just read an interesting book. It's called Smuggler Nation, and it's about the entire history of the U.S. from colonial times to the present. And it turns out Americans have been smuggling stuff in and into this country from almost the very beginning. The original colonists were smuggling things out of England and other countries into the U.S. So we've got a long history of smuggling. As a matter of fact, a lot of the original founding fathers were smugglers. George Washington owned the largest distillery on the east coast of the United States. And he grew marijuana too. It's called hemp, but it's the same product. So in any case, the potency issue is one that where prohibition drives production and distribution to very highly potent products. So that you can well imagine that during alcohol prohibition from 1920 to 1933, during that 13-year period, Americans used to be beer drinkers. Drank a lot of whiskey too, and a little bit of wine. During prohibition, almost all the production and certainly almost entirely all of the illegal production was in highly potent whiskey. So they would typically be making like 150 proof whiskey or bathtub gin or something like that. So whereas before Prohibition, Americans spent about 40 cents on every alcohol dollar on whiskey, during Prohibition, it was more than 90 cents of every alcohol dollar was spent on whiskey. With marijuana prohibition, the potency of marijuana increased from about a half a percent potency in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, when the war on drugs, Nixon's war on drugs, that's another one of his great blunders. He started the modern war on drugs, and the potency of marijuana was about a half a percent. By 1984, the potency of marijuana was 4.5% on average. The stuff that was being confiscated and tested by the U.S. government, I don't know who was doing that testing, but or how they were testing it. But it increased by basically 1,000%. The potency of marijuana has increased significantly since then, but when I was doing my dissertation, I wrote the people who were doing the testing and asked them for a copy of their report. And it's someplace over in Mississippi, actually, that they did this testing. And they sent me the report, and it was the 1985 report, so I had data 1984 back into the 70s. And then as I was finishing my dissertation, and I wanted to update the data, so I called them and asked them to send the report, and they said, "What report?" And they said, "You weren't supposed to get that report." So I never got the updated data on that, but from reports, you know, issued by the government, as well as anecdotal reports from testing labs in the state of Washington, the potency of marijuana has increased significantly since then. So the producers of the of that product in South America and Mexico and other places typically are driving the market towards higher and higher potencies. That's also been the case with production of marijuana in the United States, where it's mostly indoor production. And so they want to try to grow those plants as quickly as possible and get the most potent product possible. And so they put a lot of resources into researching how to grow the stuff and what varieties to grow and under what conditions to grow, all with the purpose of increasing the potency of marijuana. During the early 1980s, under the Reagan administration, they really cracked down on drugs, particularly in the state of Florida. I was going to call him Professor Reagan. President Reagan unleashed a new wave in the war on drugs. Vice President Bush Sr. Was put in charge. He was the first drug czar, and they brought the military to play a role. And they basically sealed off the state of Florida from marijuana imports. And marijuana in the streets of Miami and Tampa basically wasn't to be had. Typically, nobody could find it. The price was astronomically high. And it was at that point that the smugglers started smuggling cocaine instead of marijuana, because cocaine was even more compact. It was easier to avoid. It didn't have the same smell, so that the drug dogs of the time weren't trained to go after it. And so they were able to temporarily displace marijuana from the market, but in its place came cocaine, which was considered even more dangerous, potentially lethal. And then other drugs, as they've stepped up the war on drugs, other drugs have come in. Heroin has seen a resurgence in use and addiction. And recently the government made a statement that the drugs that it does prohibit currently are actually a lot safer to consumers than the drugs that they haven't prohibited. That all of these new chemically produced drugs in underground chemical labs, where they manipulate the chemical properties of the drugs so that they're not technically illegal, but they're much more dangerous and even lethal, is just a continuation of this trend that the war on drugs creates higher potency and more dangerous products. So when we look at the quantity, the price, those factors almost seem irrelevant compared to things like higher potency drugs, more dangerous drugs, more lethal drugs, drugs that are where consumers are more likely to overdose and do really stupid things, are much more prominent in the market as a result. Yes. I think that, yes, the question is, in a free market where there is no prohibition, would there also be a tendency for higher potency? There's two things about that. One is that for certain uses, I think that you would get a demand for higher potency marijuana. And with medical marijuana, they're growing and producing this stuff with the idea of producing unique products to address unique health issues, so that sometimes they grow marijuana of a certain variety to a certain potency to help induce sleep, and other varieties and other potencies to produce increased appetite. And then there's other varieties and potencies that are directed towards pain minimization. So for those uses, I think that those type of uses that there is a market-driven phenomenon towards higher potency. But I've also seen stories where marijuana users in Holland, Netherlands, were actually, a few years ago, there were stories about, oh, this pot is just too potent, and, you know, you can't take it, you know, I can't go back to work afterwards or whatever. So I think the market response would be for for products where the potency is known by the consumer, where it's fairly stable and over time, and so I think that the demand would be for a higher quality product, and quality involves, you know, knowing what the potency is in advance, being able to predict its effects, and to bring in other attributes into the marketplace. Like with cigarettes, tobacco cigarettes, they come where the tobacco is all cut up into little pieces, and it's rolled with paper, and it's got a filter on it. It's all rolled up into a package, and, you know, so there's other attributes to it. Where marijuana just comes in a big bag. You got to start from scratch, so to speak. Okay, a couple questions.
In this bucket, it seems to seem that the level of risk doesn't increase with the potency. $7,000 of risk.
Right.
But if law enforcement agencies increase the amount of punishment in accordance with how much drug was being smuggled, how strong the drug was, does the conclusion still hold?
Well, the probability of capture is going to be about the same. They could. Yeah, they could adjust the punishment, but they don't. So it's possible, but I don't think it would have a major impact, even if they said, oh, this is, you know, they actually, the law enforcement agencies, what they really like to do is they like to find the marijuana while it's growing, right before it's harvested. So you've got these giant plants that they cut down, and it's got no flowers on it whatsoever at this point, but it's just a big, big giant plant with lots of stalks and lots of leaves. And so they cut all that down, and they weigh it. And it's not worth a thing, really. But they weigh it, and then they multiply it times the street price. And they get this astronomical figure. You know, we just busted, you know, $100 million worth of marijuana, and it's actually not worth a thing on the streets. Question back there? Yes, that's absolutely the case. So you get higher potency in products and more variable potency. Both of these things lead to major increases in health consequences in these marketplaces. Now, before narcotics prohibition by the Harrison Narcotic Act in 1917, in the Marijuana Tax Act of the 1930s, there was marijuana available in the economy. There were narcotics, morphine. You could buy some of the stuff, syringes, right out of the Sears catalog. Cocaine was the main ingredient, or the important ingredient, in Coca-Cola. The Bayer Pharmaceutical Companies sold heroin pills that were prescribed by doctors for babies, people with dysentery, and other classes for other ailments. It was a very effective product, and there were no overdoses reported. There were no major medical implications. There was a problem of people becoming addicted to morphine and opium, but people weren't overdosing on the scale that Americans and others are overdosing, having to go to the emergency room. We're talking about tens of thousands of people overdosing and dying, and many tens of thousands of people ending up in the emergency room of hospitals as a result of overdoses and complications due to the consumption of these illegal drugs. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's a major problem, and it's a distinction of a prohibited market, is that there are no real brand names, there's no recourse, you know, you can't be harmed by heroin or cocaine or something, and then, you know, take your drug dealer to court and sue him for a tort, and so the market is gone here, and so the market forces and the legal system that we typically rely on to protect us don't come into play here. So what these products are cut with or mixed with to reduce their potency as it goes through the chain of distribution, the consumers don't know what it's being cut with or how much it's being cut with. And typically speaking, they're not using, you know, commercial pharmaceutical grade substitutes to try to reduce the potency. You know, it's just somebody in his chemical lab, you know, cutting it with whatever he can come across. And so that creates a lot of danger. And typically that's what does cause a lot of the overdoses, is the product wasn't cut enough or wasn't cut as much as it typically is. And so when the user is taking a dose of something like heroin or cocaine, they may be getting four or five times the amount that they typically would get. And so, continuing with the legal theme, the distribution of these illegal products is not, they're not being distributed by Walmart or Kmart. They're not being sold by commercial firms that have reputations to uphold. They have to meet regulations and be legally liable for what they're doing. The distribution chain is by drug cartels. Recently, there was the leader of a Mexican drug cartel that was apprehended, but the federal government readily admits that apprehending the leader of one of these drug cartels has absolutely no impact on price or distribution. It's just you've got the top guy, but there's already people already in place to take over when somebody is apprehended. So the system, these drug cartels, are set up with the idea that, yes, they're eventually going to get the leaders, they're going to get some of the distributors of the drug cartel, but they can't really take down the drug cartels. And even if when they do take down an entire system, a new system springs up to replace it. But the drug cartels are very violent groups. They impose order within their organization with violence. They maintain order between the drug cartel and its suppliers and its distributors with violence. And in recent years, they actually engage the military and police forces and political systems and court systems in South American and Central American countries with violence. So it's a source, a major source of violence in society, and it actually breaks down or makes ineffective the political process, the judicial process, the economy, law enforcement, the protection of private property, and so forth. It also, drug prohibition is also responsible in the United States for organized crime. It's one of the major sources of income for organized crime. It's really the source of income for street gangs. You know, there's estimated to be more than 2 million members of street gangs in the United States, several hundred thousand of them in prison, and multiple millions out of prison. These people, along with organized crime, enforce their sales territories, enforce their contracts with violence, and so they are a major source of violence in urban areas. Drive-by shootings are almost always associated with the illegal drug business. And so when we look at crime, we look at violent crime, a major source of that crime in the U.S. as well as the supplier countries is illegal drugs. And so when we're looking at the price and the quantity of something, as we did initially, I mean, that really doesn't matter. I mean, if you're creating the major source of crime, the major source of violence, a huge percentage of your prison population, more than probably 1 million people, and the cost of all that, this supply and demand stuff, really, it really doesn't matter. The small decrease, or even if it was a large decrease in the number of consumers, it doesn't seem to really matter at all compared to the fact that the ones that are still consuming are consuming a much higher potency product, a much more dangerous product. And to go with that, we're creating the number one source of crime, the number one source of violence, the number one source of prison of the prisoner population, in the number one source of bribery and corruption in the U.S. None of that seems to matter. And so when we look at the social benefits of prohibition, you know, what were we supposed to get? Well, we're supposed to be healthier. That didn't work. We're supposed to make society better. You know, people won't be beating their wives or beating their kids or whatever because they're not on drugs. Well, that's not really happening. You know, what's happening is people are building meth labs in Opelika, Alabama. So this really doesn't work. And the only reason that we have prohibition today is, well, first of all, the state wants it. The state needs the war on drugs. They have to have a visual symbol of their power and authority. And prohibition is the sword of the state. We don't see the state really imposing its power and authority in a violent way, typically as Americans. We really wouldn't put up with it. But we do hear reports of newspaper reports, television reports about drug cartels being, you know, disbanded and meth labs being found and destroyed, prisoners being taken away. We see the court docket, and, you know, with half of the court cases being drug-related. So that's the one area where the state visibly takes out its sword and uses it on Americans. So we see that power, that authority, those guns, the black uniforms. Because it certainly isn't the typical social benefits that we were told alcohol prohibition was going to provide, or that narcotics prohibition was supposed to provide, of better citizens, healthier, harder working, or whatever. I mean, that's just not, that just doesn't materialize, and it certainly doesn't materialize in this black market at all. You get no benefits and nothing but cost. And so the reduction in consumption doesn't really matter. Who are we preventing from accessing marijuana and narcotics drugs? I mean, it's not really prohibiting anybody. There's access to these drugs. And you can get, there were stories about where you could actually buy drugs right outside the Drug Enforcement Agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And you can buy illegal drugs in prisons. You know, if prisoners in federal prisons can buy drugs, then who can't buy drugs? Question. Well, yeah, I mean, if you can avoid prohibition somehow, then you're going to see some of the benefits that the market can provide. And so in these states where medical marijuana has been made legalized and the feds have not come down hard on them, you start to see the material benefits that a market can provide as prohibition is kept at bay, at least temporarily. The benefits of markets start to reappear. And it's important to remember, I think a lot of people say, well, you know, prohibition is bad, but these illegal drugs are bad. And, you know, look at what's going on with illegal drugs. There's violence, there's murders. During alcohol prohibition, the murder rate in the U.S. went from 5 murders per 100,000 people per year to 10 murders per 100,000 people per year. So roughly speaking, can't say for sure, but roughly speaking, the murder rate in the United States doubled. And when alcohol prohibition was repealed, it took a few years, but the murder rate fell back to 5 murders per 100,000 people per year. So if the typical person is looking at the situation and they say, well, if we legalize these drugs, the price would fall, you'd get more consumption, and the idea is, well, all of these other problems would increase as well. So if consumption of these illegal drugs doubled in free markets, then the typical American would say, well, we're just going to double all these problems. But that's not really the case. the marketplace actually, in a sense, has a will to keep the consumption of these drugs well regulated. First of all, you'd have brand names, you'd have known potencies. The people who produced these drugs in legally would have liability for problems associated with the consumption of these drugs. They wouldn't be willing to sell very dangerous drugs to minors, because anything the minor did associated with the consumption of those drugs, the producer and the seller would be, in a sense, doubly liable for the negative consequences of the consumption by minors. So, and it's also the case that with free markets, you couldn't just do whatever you wanted to. So you couldn't just come into the Mises Institute and light up a joint. Okay, Lou Rockwell would not put up with that. We don't put up with cigarettes, so, I mean, marijuana would obviously also be off the limit. You couldn't go into a church and just smoke marijuana or take out a needle and inject heroin. You know, businesses and institutions have rules that you have to obey. You know, when you go into a 7-Eleven and it says no shirt, no shoes, no service, well, they can put all sorts of requirements on you that you not do before coming into their institution. Commercial companies would also put restrictions on truck drivers and airplane pilots and anybody using heavy equipment or dangerous equipment. You wouldn't want, you know, if your dentist was getting stoned before drilling on people's teeth, pretty soon he probably wouldn't have any customers. So the marketplace imposes a will that restricts the use and abuse of those products, as well as anything that was legalized. There would still be rules that society imposed, and note that those rules are actually better obeyed, and that people have respect for those rules, and that they don't have really any respect for rules of prohibition. Yes, sir. Yeah, the idea is that the support for marijuana prohibition in particular has declined significantly over time, and I believe that's going to continue over time because people see, particularly with respect to marijuana, that it doesn't have the evil social consequences that have been associated with it in the past. I mean, when they started the Marijuana Tax Act in the 1930s, very few people smoked pot. There was no problems associated with it. It was something you could go to the pharmacy and get. And you could get raw pot, or you could get marijuana mixed in with various other things. It was used as a liniment for muscle pain on both people and on horses. There was no support for it at all. And so the bureaucracy had to vilify it. And there's basically the only good thing that the drug enforcement agencies and all of its past renditions have been any good at is public relations. And they're losing that battle because of the tremendous negative consequences that it's imposing on society, particularly amongst minority groups. And so, even in Alabama, 2 years ago, there was a poll that said that 74% of Alabamians of Alabamians support legalized medical marijuana. And so you can clearly see the writing on the wall that things have to change. And it's the fact that ideas in people's heads are pushing this forward. And it's going to continue to push in that direction in terms of legalizing medical marijuana and legalizing marijuana itself. And the state is really in a rear guard action situation where they're trying to put off the inevitable. And like in California, when Proposition 19 came up, everybody in the political structure came out against it. The governor, the former governors, the former lieutenant governors, the attorney general, senators, everybody came out against it and made up these ridiculous arguments why not to support Prop 19 legalizing marijuana. The legislature eliminated the state prohibition and instead imposed a $100 fine. And their efforts were successful, but basically it's a rearguard action where they want to put off the inevitable, which is states legalizing marijuana for personal consumption. Now, that is a powerful result. It's the people and the legislatures standing up to the federal government on what is, in some people's mind, a trivial issue, and saying, we're nullifying your rule. Your rule no longer applies to us. So it's an act of nullification against the federal government and all of the international conventions and institutions that have been established over the last 100 years to prohibit this thing. So it's an important act of nullification, questioning the authority of the central government. Now, the central government, I anticipate, as it's done in California, tried to shut down the medical marijuana establishments by threatening bankers, by threatening landlords, that we're going to take your property, that mortgage is not going to be any good, we're going to basically steal it unless you get rid of that tenant who's selling medical marijuana. And I think they're probably also going to go after people in Washington and in Colorado. And the key thing is, if these people are brought to trial, and at that point, I think that if juries nullify those trials, and where those juries say, the person is guilty, but we're not going to declare him guilty, we're going to declare that person free, and we're nullifying your act of trying to intervene in the activities of people within the state of California, Washington, Colorado, whatever it happens to be. So it's a second level of nullification, using jury nullification to nullify the acts of federal law enforcement. So I think that actually, if we get to that stage, that's going to be a very, very powerful result. If people realize that the central government authority doesn't really have all of the power to rule over all of our lives in a central fashion, but can be nullified by acts of the people. That's what I'm hoping. I mean, I'm hoping that the realization that we're actually in charge. It's not the power elite. It's not the establishment. It's not the bureaucracy that's really in charge, that we are really in charge. And we don't have to take marijuana prohibition. We don't have to take the national debt. We don't have to take runaway spending on idiotic projects. We don't have to take foreign interventions into other countries' affairs, because it just blows back on the American population in physical ways and in ways that where foreigners don't like us. You know, at one point in history, Americans were considered, you know, the light on the hill. That we were, you know, everybody wanted to be like Americans. And now you go overseas and it's like, you know, not quite as entertaining. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's definitely true. There's a reason why these things are prohibited. It benefits the government itself. Okay, the government has bigger guns and bigger budgets and more authority as a result of prohibition. But it's also the case that marijuana is a competitor. Marijuana can be used for fiber. It can be used for fuel. It can be used for medicine. Medically speaking, it's sort of one-stop shopping. It can alleviate a lot of problems for people. With alcohol prohibition, I recently learned that, I guess I knew this, but I never put two and two together. But you know how we're using ethanol in our gasoline today? Well, in the early days of the automobile, it was an open question whether automobiles would use alcohol or would use gasoline or kerosene as a fuel. And some models of the early automobiles were built specifically with alcohol-designed engines, and others were designed with kerosene or gasoline in mind. And you know who the largest donor to the prohibition movement was? You can guess. You can figure it out. Rockefeller, the owner of Standard Oil. The use of his product for lighting, kerosene was initially used for lighting, to light your homes with. Used whale oil. The whales started dying out, so the market came up with kerosene, so people were using kerosene to light their homes. And then electricity came in, and nobody wanted the stinky old kerosene lights. They wanted electric lights. And so the demand for Rockefeller's product was declining. Then the automobile came in, and it was an open question whether automobiles would use alcohol or ethanol or gasoline. So Rockefeller became the largest donor to the prohibition movement, the anti-saloon league. His money allowed the printing up of millions of pamphlets and posters that were the main method of spreading the support for alcohol prohibition. And so inevitably, there's always somebody who's trying to make money off of prohibition. In Prop 19, the Beer Distributors Association of California came out against legalizing marijuana because they said if our truck drivers drove their trucks while smoking marijuana, they would be a hazard to society. And they ended up not only donating money, but they also donated money to some minister in California who has like the largest church in California, has a TV program and all this. And so they paid him to go on a tirade, an advertising campaign against legalizing marijuana. But yeah, there always is money behind the scenes. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much.